is CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor. Here's John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. It's a great pleasure to welcome Colonel Jeff McCausland, the author, Colonel Jeff McCausland, of the book Battle Tested, Gettysburg Leadership Lessons for 21st Century Leaders. We step aside a moment from Jeff's analysis for CBS News of the 21st century contest, and we wander into the events of July 1st, 2nd, and 3rd, 1863, the center of the battle between the Confederacy and the Union. 25 battles, Jeff informs us, are the battle stars of the United States military remembering the Civil War. Gettysburg is number 13, right in the middle. We begin with a romantic character named John Buford, who spurns the uniform of the U.S. cavalry. He was regular cavalry before the war, and rides in on June 30th to the crossroads town of Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. Jeff, congratulations. Your book is wonderful to experience because you're putting together lessons here in the 21st century that are illustrated with decisions made in the heat of battle with unknown forces without our communication system in 1863. John Buford is a cavalry leader of 2,600 men that day. Why is he in Gettysburg? What is he looking for? Good evening to you, Jeff.
Well, first of all, John, thank you very much. It's a great honor and pleasure to be with you. What John Buford is doing is he is, if you will, screening the advance of the Union Army that is coming up. Don't forget that the Confederates had sort of stolen a march on the Yankees when they crossed the Rappahannock River, crossed the Appalachians, and head north up the Shenandoah Valley, surprising the commander at the time, Joe Hooker, who suddenly looks across the river and Lee is gone. And so then Hooker takes off and is chasing him. So this battle unfolds in Gettysburg. What's fascinating is the Confederates will enter Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, coming from the north, from the west, and from the southwest, and the Union Army will actually come up from the south. So as they're advancing north towards Gettysburg, Buford, commander of cavalry, is out front. He is screening the left wing of the Union Army, which is commanded by a guy by the name of John Reynolds. And his job is a couple of things. One is to find the enemy, identify the enemy and what the enemy intends to do, and then also identify the key terrain in the area. So as he enters Gettysburg, obviously the first thing he knows is this is key terrain because there's nine different roads that pass through the city of Gettysburg in that particular part of Pennsylvania. And while there are a lot of myths that the Confederate Army will advance on Gettysburg looking for shoes and the like, what it really boils down to is when Robert E. Lee receives word that the Union Army has crossed the Potomac and now is closer to his forces than he thought, he sends out an order for his battalion army, his particular army, to consolidate at Gettysburg, and the road network allows that to be a convenient way to come. So it's key terrain, and then as he moves just to the west of the town on the ridge lines at Seminary Ridge and McPherson's Ridge, he can actually view off in the distance by binoculars Confederate patrols out there that are patrolling towards South Mountain, and he gets reports from different scouts he sent out, from civilians and others, that the Confederates are in force to the west of the city of Gettysburg, and he also gets additional reports that there may be more Confederates who are advancing south towards Gettysburg coming from Carlisle and Harrisburg.
We know now that A.P. Hill's corps is coming down from the west, from Cashtown. In the Civil War, heavy infantry was the battlefield preference, heavy infantry. And you were very careful about why this is true. It was the weapon they used, and it was the tactics they used. The heavy infantry of A.P. Hill, numbering in the thousands, there is no way Buford can stop them, but he makes a decision. He looks at the terrain, and this is what's a joy about your book, Jeff. We get to be in the 21st century criticizing the 19th century about a battle that we know what happens, but still there are decisions within it. Buford has a choice. He can leave. He can scatter. He's got 2,600 men, and he knows that heavy infantry is coming down from the west and probably from the north because he hears from townspeople that there's something advancing from Harrisburg. Or he can deploy and what you call time, space and time. What are his choices and what are his decisions, Jeff?
Well, his choices are, and you're quite right, is to defend the town, pull way back, and look for an area outside of Gettysburg to screen for the Union Army to defend. Or he can use the ridge lines. And as you move in Gettysburg coming from west to east, there's a series of ridge lines, the farthest west being McPherson's Ridge. Then there is Seminary Ridge. And finally, and he identifies the real key terrain immediately around the town being Cemetery Ridge, anchored on the north by a Cemetery Hill and on the south by the two Round Tops, Little Round Top and Big Round Top. So he quickly analyzes with the astute eye of a cavalryman that that is the key terrain. So what he determines he can do, though, he knows he's going to be somewhere between 6 and 8 to 1 outnumbered by A.P. Hill's advancing corps, is he can occupy the ridge line most to the west, that being McPherson's Ridge, and slow the Confederates down and trade space for time. And it's one of the key things that leaders do is manage time, whether in the 19th century or the 21st century. Time often the most inelastic resource that leaders have to deal with. He does another thing which is fascinating, and that, of course, is he deploys his cavalry on the ground. He gets them off their horses, which some might say, well, that deprives them of the one thing that makes them cavalry, which, of course, is mobility. But this allows him to do two things, and that is, one, he knows his men are better shots from the ground than on the back of a horse, number one, and technologically, the carbines they carry have a shorter range than the longer-range infantry muskets carried by the heavy infantry. But if you can put them on the ground, they can start to fire, and perhaps the Confederates will think that they are, in fact, infantry, and that will cause them to slow and move more cautiously, once again, preserving time. And he had learned that particular fact, frankly, from his time on the Western frontier fighting Native Americans. So he is somewhat, I would argue, showing a certain amount of initiative and innovation in terms of, first of all, this is where we're going to fight, and second of all, how he's going to go about it. And he does a third thing, which in terms of leadership I think is key, and that is he leads his boss. And I always say smart people lead their boss consciously, less smart people lead their boss unconsciously, and smart boss is one that he led. He sends his boss, John Reynolds, who's the commander of infantry, a message which basically says, I have occupied the terrain to the west of Gettysburg. The enemy is here in force. Get the infantry up here first thing in the morning. That's about the length of the message. Reynolds receives that. He could have called Buford back, had a decision briefing or had a committee meeting or whatever, but he trusts him. And so decisions can be made by the speed of trust between leader and subordinate, in this case from Reynolds to Buford. He gets that message. He knows John Buford. If my subordinate John Buford says that's what we should do, that's what we should do. And Reynolds orders his infantry to accelerate their march on the way to Gettysburg as Buford deploys his men along McPherson's Ridge with a small screening force to the north in case the reports he has of more Confederate infantry advancing from the north turn out to be true, which they do.
Yes, they do. There's heavy infantry coming from the west. There's heavy infantry coming from the north. Buford tells his 2,600 men, we're not going to be able to defeat them, but we can buy time. So he's buying time for John Reynolds and three corps, the 1st, the 3rd, and the 11th Corps of the Union Army. When we come back, John Reynolds, the book is Battle-Tested, Gettysburg Leadership Lessons for 21st Century Leaders. I'm speaking with the author, Jeff McCausland. Colonel Jeff McCausland, United States Army, retired. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor, and it's a pleasure to speak to Colonel Jeff McCausland, United States Army, retired, the author, Jeff McCausland, of the book Battle-Tested, Gettysburg Leadership Lessons for 21st Century Leaders. It is July 1st, 1863. John Reynolds commands three corps, the left wing of the Union Army. He identifies that Gettysburg up ahead of him is likely to be a major battle. He pushes in with his advance marching corps. There's one particular unit that we now call the Iron Brigade. It's made up of men from the Midwest, in particular Wisconsin. That's what he has to throw into a battle where Buford's men are reeling back. Now, Jeff, this is a tough one because John Reynolds is much admired. You know Gettysburg Battlefield very well. There's a statue to where he fell. And yet, why was he so far up front, the commander of three corps?
That's a great question. In fact, he was not only the commander of three corps, John. He had been given, we call in the military, operational command of that entire left wing of those three corps. So in total, for operational purposes, he was in command of 25,000 Union soldiers. They arrive on Gettysburg. As you said, they go to McPherson's Ridge with the Iron Brigade. Reynolds has been decisively engaged, and they're now moving the cavalry out to the flanks, and the Iron Brigade and the infantry are now taking over the centerpiece of the battle. Reynolds moves well forward and begins to position individual regiments, and he gets to a certain area where the Iron Brigade is, and there is about 840 men from a regiment from Wisconsin. Reynolds actually rides up, only guy now on horseback in that area amongst the Union soldiers, and he says, "Forward, men, forward, for God's sake, drive those people from the trees right there." As he gives that particular order, bam, a musket ball hits John Reynolds in the back of the head, and he is dead before he literally hits the ground. And this is a good teaching point for leaders, because in any crisis, even the 21st century, I always say to leaders, still in all, despite our technology, where you are physically is an incredibly important decision for you to make. And when you think about John Reynolds, you certainly admire him for his courage. He was a highly admired officer. He'd been offered command of the Army of the Potomac by Lincoln, and for a host of reasons had turned that down. But that particular day, even though he was commanding 25,000, when he's killed in battle, he's actually commanding 840. So the question then is, why would he do that? Why shouldn't he have been farther back orchestrating the maneuver of that larger force, whereas when he goes forward, he's actually only commanding a handful? And you can argue this a whole bunch of ways as a teaching point. One could argue, on the one hand, being far forward, it was a critical moment for the organization, an existential moment, and therefore the leader being present was invaluable, even though he was killed in the fight. Or you can argue somewhat that John Reynolds was, in fact, even though a great man, a great leader, and very courageous, he was micromanaging his organization, because there was a colonel in the command of that regiment, and Reynolds could have simply given him orders and allowed him to deploy his forces. Either way, it's an interesting teaching point even for 21st century leaders, but sadly for the Union Army, John Reynolds is dead after only a few hours on the battlefield.
Robert E. Lee, the extremely dominating leader of the Confederate Army, has in his mind something that is not obvious when you first read this story. And you make a point of it, Jeff, because some of the decisions that Lee forces on his men are on the basis of his assumption that there is not time to win this war if we're matching battle for battle. We've got to win decisively. Do I say correctly that Lee has in his mind he must destroy the Union Army? Because if he continues to bleed the Union Army, as his army bleeds, he will lose. Does he think that when he arrives on the battlefield?
Well, I sort of think that is true, John. I mean, I tell people when Robert E. Lee comes north in the spring and summer of 1863, he's not coming north to win a battle. He's coming north to win the war. For the reasons you say, he suggests, you know, we're winning battles, but we're losing the war because we just don't have the men and materiel that the Union can put on the field. And at the same time, of course, even though the war is going fairly well for the Confederacy in the East, Lee has just had stunning victories at Fredericksburg in December of 1862, nearly destroys the Union Army at Chancellorsville in May of 1863. The war is going poorly for the South, particularly in the West. And as this battle unfolds, of course, the last Confederate stronghold on the Mississippi River is under siege by Ulysses S. Grant, that being Vicksburg. And when that falls, of course, the Union then will have full control of the Mississippi River and basically divide the Confederacy in half. So following those two victories at Fredericksburg and Chancellorsville, I think Lee really believes this is the moment that we can push it over the edge. If I can just defeat the Yankees again, particularly on northern territory, and then perhaps threaten the major city. Their goal initially was Harrisburg as a state capital of a very important state, but perhaps then to Philadelphia or Baltimore or perhaps even Washington. If I can do that, I can tip this war, if not militarily, I can tip this war politically, knowing full well that Abraham Lincoln is going to face the voters in the fall of 1864. Perhaps the Union would then elect a president more amenable to negotiating a settlement that would allow the Confederacy to become independent. So I really believe it's Lee's goal to win the war by a decisive victory at Gettysburg.
And yet, Richard Ewell, leading the corps from the north, Jackson's corps, Richard Ewell is the youngest of the corps commanders, Longstreet and Hill, and he has an opportunity that first day to overwhelm the Reynolds' three corps, overwhelm and win the battle. However, Lee sends him what you call a discretionary order. Does that suggest that Lee was not thinking he was going to win the battle or was being cautious? I puzzle about this, Jeff.
No, I don't think it was, frankly, John, I don't think it was either of those things. I think it was just a matter of Robert E. Lee's leadership style. And each one of us has a leadership style that we're comfortable with for those who work for us. And that style will operate on an extreme from absolute total control to absolute total empowerment. And we all operate somewhere on that particular continuum. Lee liked to empower his subordinates, liked to give them broad guidance and allow them to operate, and had found over the last 16 months that he'd been in command that that had afforded him many opportunities for success. But I think what he fails to realize is that the people he's commanding have now changed significantly in a real big way, and that is, of course, for the Confederates, the loss of Thomas Stonewall Jackson, who was shot by his own men and killed at Chancellorsville, is a big hole. And Lee has decided in the few weeks prior to coming north that he's going to reorganize the Confederate Army and move it from having just two corps to having three corps. He has to elevate a lower-ranking officer, in this case Ewell, to take over the command of the corps that Jackson was in command with, and Ewell had been one of Jackson's subordinates, and then also make A.P. Hill the commander of a newly formed corps, because the Confederate Army will be about the largest it's going to be throughout the war, about 75,000 or so troops. So that leadership style that Lee had enjoyed and found worked for him doesn't work quite so well when I give that guidance of discretion to Ewell, who was not used to that, who had only been a corps commander for a couple of weeks now, as opposed to Jackson. And there's been many conjectures, even been books written about, well, what would have happened if Stonewall Jackson had been present. I can tell you, in my humble opinion, if Jackson had been there and had gotten that discretionary order, he would have continued the attack. That was his style, very aggressive. So I think Lee is really following his instincts and his style, and really, in many ways, though people hold Ewell at fault for not progressing aggressively, I really fault Lee, really, because I think he should have realized the new person he had in command and adjusted his style accordingly and been more direct if that's what he wanted him to do.
The book is battle-tested, Gettysburg Leadership Lessons for 21st Century Leaders. Jeff McCausland is the author. It's the end of the first day. The Union forces are arriving through the night. The Confederate forces have arrived and are in position for the second day of the Battle of Gettysburg. Lee is going to have a very important conversation with his corps commander, his veteran corps commander, James Longstreet, when we come back. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm speaking to Colonel Jeff McCausland, United States Army, retired. I'm John Batchelor.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor, and it's a pleasure to speak of a book battle-tested with the author, Jeff McCausland, Colonel Jeff McCausland, United States Army, retired. He's at CBS News, but right now he's an author. Battle-tested is about Gettysburg leadership lessons from 1863 for 21st century leaders, and their lessons in all directions. We now come to a conversation and a meeting of the minds between James Longstreet, the corps commander, a veteran corps commander, they're all veterans of West Point and the Mexican War, and Robert E. Lee. And the question is, on the second day, having not overrun the Union forces on the first day, through the night, the Union has arrived and created what is called a fishhook from Gettysburg south along Cemetery Ridge to Little and Big and Little Round Top. James Longstreet comes forward with an idea that the battle does not have to be decided by a frontal assault. It can be decided by maneuver. Jeff, Longstreet's speech to Lee is convincing here in the 21st century. Would it have been convincing in the 19th century to avoid battle, place yourself between the enemies, the enemy and the capital, and make them attack you? Would that have made sense in those days?
Well, I think it would have, because if you look back, particularly at Fredericksburg, the Confederates had found they were most successful when they were on the defense and the Yankees were attacking them. So clearly, based on technology and maneuver and mobility and a number of things, it seems like the defense has a certain number of advantages. So when Longstreet meets with Lee, of course, Lee suggests that we're going to attack them if they're at that place. That's what he would say. Longstreet replies, you know, Lee, if they're still there tomorrow, they want you to attack them at that place. But Lee still persists, and next morning, of course, he'll issue his orders for that particular attack. So it's massive conjecture, again, that if they had followed Longstreet's advice, Gettysburg would have been a one-day battle and a Confederate victory, but the more decisive battle would have been later, as the Confederates tried to maneuver south of the Union Army, head down towards Washington. The Yankees would have to follow them, find a good piece of terrain, occupy it, and then let the Yankees attack them. Well, in some ways, that sounds persuasive. Don't forget, one of the problems that Robert E. Lee had was Jeb Stuart is absent. Jeb Stuart, his cavalry is missing, and they've been off on a long raid and have lost contact with the main body. And to conduct the maneuver, I would argue that Longstreet was recommending, Lee was going to need that cavalry to screen the advance, screen the flank of the army so they weren't be attacked while in motion, identify the proper routes, the bridges, and et cetera, that they could use. And not having that cavalry there really made the maneuver that Longstreet was recommending to swing around and try to threaten Washington difficult, if not impossible.
The accusation against Longstreet is that he gets the slows and does not launch his attack till late in the day. But this is, I believe, an illustration of a commander, a boss, a leader, who does not get a buy-in from his subordinates. How does it work, Jeff?
Well, I think that's very true. How it works is about 8 o'clock in the morning the second day, Robert E. Lee will head down Seminary Ridge. He'll encounter Pete Longstreet, and he'll say, okay, here's what I want you to do. I want you to take your corps. I want you to maneuver down on the southern end of the battlefield, and I want you to attack the left flank of the Union Army, and hopefully we'll roll them up. He then goes off, Lee, and he says, I want you to get in moving as soon as possible. He then goes off and goes around to the northern end of the battlefield to confer directly with Richard Ewell and perhaps give him a bit more direction than he had on the afternoon of day one. Lee will return about noon. Longstreet says, well, you know, I'm still waiting for some of my forces to arrive, and I don't want to go into battle with one boot off. That's an actual quote. But he actually gets underway. As they begin moving down the ridgeline, they realize they could be seen by Union forces on Cemetery Ridge. And so they literally turn around, march all the way back up to the start point, march a little bit farther west, and then come around to get in position for the attack. So the attack that was, in Lee's mind, supposed to occur at around noon that day doesn't begin until about 5 o'clock in the afternoon. And as you pointed out a few moments ago, John, throughout the day, more and more Union forces are arriving. This is what we call in military parlance a meeting engagement as forces continue to arrive. And as they arrive, that fishhook, it continues to extend farther and farther south, ultimately to the point where we have Union forces now on Little Round Top at the very, very southern end of that Union line.
The concern now is on the Union side. And now we move over to a decision that is, in many ways, insubordination. A man by the name of Vincent, a strong Vincent, is commanding a brigade, and he's given an order to pass to his commander to reinforce the left flank, little Round Top and Big Round Top. And he cannot find his commander. He's been ordered to march into Longstreet's combat in something called the Peach Orchard or the Wheat Field. However, he decides on his own that since he couldn't secure the left flank of the battlefield for the Union, he's going to do it himself. Jeff, this is an extraordinary moment. He has no permission from his commanders. He takes it entirely upon himself. And as you mentioned, if he hadn't been killed in the combat, he might have been court-martialed.
It's very possible. I mean, this is all created in part because of another Union general, corps commander, the name of Dan Sickles, who's the only non-West Point corps commander on either side, extraordinary figure in his own right. He's a Union general because he's a politician, and Abraham Lincoln had realized one way to keep the Democrats in the war was make some Democrats generals, and Sickles was one who got the nod as a general officer. Sickles' Third Corps arrives on the southern end of the line, but he thinks that there is better terrain forward of the line, so he advances his troops, as you suggest, John, to the wheat field and peach orchard. He does that without direction from Meade or even informing Meade, the overall commander. This places a bulge in the Union line and actually a gap between Sickles' northern unit and the most southern unit on his flank. And suddenly, of course, the Confederates attack, and he is decisively engaged. And that's when the General Sykes' division that Vincent is part of gets an order to reinforce that left flank, which is crumbling, which is Sickles. As Strong Vincent is advancing with his brigade, his orders to go to the wheat field, he intercepts a courier, which is a messenger. And the messenger is from a gentleman by the name of Gouverneur Warren. And Gouverneur Warren is the engineer officer for the entire Army of the Potomac, a brigadier general, who has no command authority. He is a staff officer to advise the commander, General Meade. But he has gone up on Little Round Top, realizes this is really key terrain, and there's nobody up here but a few signal soldiers, and sends a messenger trying to find General Sykes, recommending, urging him to put troops on the Round Top. Nobody can find Sykes, and to this day, and I've done research, I still can't figure out where Sykes was. But he does run into Strong Vincent. Vincent says, "You have orders." He reads the message, realizes that this is not a directive because it can't be, but makes a quick assessment of the situation and does realize this is the critical terrain, Little Round Top. And even though my orders tell me to go someplace else, he immediately, as you suggest, disobeys the orders he has, demonstrates clear initiative, and orders his troops up onto a Little Round Top, his three brigades, one of which commanded, of course, by the rather famous Joshua Chamberlain of the 20th Maine. And if, I'm totally convinced, had Vincent not done that, the Confederates would have overrun a Little Round Top, compromised the Union line, and Gettysburg would have been a two-day battle and a Confederate victory.
The action on Little Round Top and Big Round Top are notable, but we're going to move on to General Meade, because at the end of the second day, General Meade, who's only commanded the Army of the Potomac for a few weeks now, since Hooker was relieved of duty by the President of the United States, Meade is not a Lee-style commander. Meade likes to confer with his subordinates, and there's a meeting in his headquarters in which the junior and senior commanders all participate. The recollection is from one particular participant, John Gibbon. What about Meade's style is useful here in the 21st century, Jeff?
Well, I think it's fascinating to contrast Meade's style to Robert E. Lee as well. I mean, these two guys are in totally different positions in terms of being a leader. Robert E. Lee has been in command for 16 months. He's been very, very successful. He was widely known in the Federal Army, was famous, was offered command of the Union Army at the onset of the Civil War and turned it down to return to the Confederacy. So he's really kind of a rock star. He's kind of an icon. Meade is placed in command of the Army of Potomac 2 days before the battle. He receives the directive from the president on the 28th of June, when he's woken up in the middle of the night and told he's now in command. So he's a rookie. He's just now in command, and he suddenly realized he's been elevated from being a corps commander, and he's leading his peer group. And a number of the people that he is leading, none of the other generals, a couple of them actually outrank him by his day of rank. I'm sure a number of them thought they were a whole lot smarter than Meade. So Meade's in a very different position vis-a-vis his immediate followers. And as a consequence, I think he has to build a certain amount of consensus. You know, we like to use, John, in the book, a definition of leadership provided by Dwight Eisenhower, that leadership's about deciding what has to be done and then getting others to want to do it. And so Meade takes the time that evening to have the meeting you described to try to build consensus, which he does for the Union Army to defend on the third day. Now, frankly, from some of the things he had written, and I've talked to a number of historians, I'm pretty well convinced that's what Meade was going to do anyway. but he felt a need to build that consensus, particularly because he was new in command. It's interesting to contrast that again to Robert E. Lee on that fateful night, one of the most fateful nights, I think, in American history. Lee doesn't see hardly anybody. He goes to his headquarters. He contemplates his plans to himself, keeps his own counsel in determining what he's going to do. And he couldn't contrast this differently than what Meade does. Meade actually considers three alternatives through his generals. Should we stay? Should we retreat? Or should we actually attack the Confederates on the third day? And as you suggest, they actually vote on this, beginning with the most junior officer, moving up to the most senior, so the juniors would not be intimidated by those who outranked them. And they decide, we will stay and defend on the third day.
The third day of the battle. Battle tested. Gettysburg leadership lessons for 21st century leaders. Jeff McCausland, Colonel Jeff McCausland, United States Army retired, is the author. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Colonel Jeff McCausland, United States Army retired author Jeff McCausland of the book Battle Tested, Gettysburg Leadership Lessons for the 21st Century Leaders. We come to the payoff, the third day of the battle. Lee orders an assault on the center of the Union line. And Jeff, is it still in Lee's mind on that third day with all of the losses? I think some units were 50% down. All of the losses that he can still overwhelm the Union Army and win the war here. Is he thinking that on the third day?
Well, it certainly seems to be the case, John, that what he thinks, and I think he thinks this is also one of our last opportunities. And what I find fascinating, though, is best we can piece together what he says and does with his subordinates. He keeps that, though, to himself, and it seems to me he might have inspired Longstreet in particular, who's the key corps commander for this fateful attack, if he had simply said, you know, Pete, this is, I think, our last opportunity for a major success, and we've got to take an enormous amount of risk in that regard. And I use that to talk about the difference between risk and gamble. And those are different things. If you're going to gamble, you'll go to Las Vegas and you'll throw ivory or you'll play with cards. Risk is a matter of calculation, the possible great loss, but possible great success that all organizations have to make. And you're not going to risk the very existence of your organization over something that's trivial, but you might risk a large portion of the existence of your organization over something that was truly decisive for its very purpose. And clearly, gaining independence, winning the war, was what Robert E. Lee thought was the case, and therefore he's going to take this enormous risk. Secondly, I think what's quite different is how they have structured themselves. The Union Army has begun to organize an intelligence analysis cell at the headquarters of the Army of the Potomac to analyze their opponents. So by the third day, the guy who's heading that up can actually describe to George Meade pretty much the full laydown of the Confederate Army, pieced together by deserters and other information that they've managed to gain. Robert E. Lee has nothing like that. So while George Meade is making decisions based on data analysis, you could say, Robert E. Lee is still going with his gut. It's kind of intuitive. The Yankees were strong on the North on day one. They were strong on the South on day two. We had successes. They weren't decisive. So the weak point on the battlefield must be the center. And that's why he determines that's where he's going to throw the last fresh forces he has, which in this case is primarily Pickett's division of Virginians.
Winfield Scott Hancock is commanding the center. And the night before, Meade has identified the center as where the attack's going to be. Did that inspire the defenders to think that their commander had seen ahead, had understood Lee's tactics?
Yeah, I think so. And the other thing, of course, that Meade has done is, along with talking to his commanders and getting their opinion on what we should do, he also took the time to talk to them about what's the status of your troops, how's your ammunition, how's morale, and all those kind of things, and do some reallocation. And it always surprised me that Robert E. Lee doesn't at least have that kind of a council that night to redistribute forces. Consequently, as Lee is riding down that early in the morning of the second day to give Longstreet his instructions for the attack, there are some historical reports that suggest that he's somewhat surprised about the number of wounded that he sees. And he even talks about, well, there'll be about 15,000 troops in this particular attack. Well, when you actually calculate them up based on the casualties, as you suggested, John, it's probably more like about 12,500. So it's somewhat curious whether or not Lee had a full understanding of the strengths and weaknesses of his own organization. And this brings up another fascinating leadership point to me, and that is there are some suggestions that Lee is not exactly in the best health. We know he has a bad back. We know he has dysentery. There have been some suggestions that he has a mild heart attack. He will die of heart disease about 5 years after the war is over. So he's perhaps not in the best physical condition while still being forced to make very, very important decisions for an organization, a lesson any leader should take into consideration.
Pickett's charge, so-called, is an advance on the center of the Union line in the face of an enormous amount of long-range cannon. It's still difficult to read, Jeff.
Yeah, about two out of every three people who begin that particular attack will be dead, wounded, missing, or never heard of again. The whole attack, of course, begins about 1 o'clock with an artillery barrage of over 100 guns on the Confederate side. That will go on for 2 hours. And then about 3 o'clock, they will step off as they move across the 1.1 miles that separate Seminary Ridge from Cemetery Ridge and the angle in the wall, as you suggest, John. It's, you know, it's almost brutal to think about this, but as they're advancing, there are reports in diaries of officers and NCOs on the Confederate side who are behind their troops, which was where they were supposed to be to keep them online, and the things they're saying to the men. What are they saying? Well, they're saying things like, home, boys, home. Home is just over that hill. If we can crack the Union lines and win today, you get to go home, back to that idea of winning the war. And also, I think it shows for those troops the cohesion of the organization. And I often talk when I'm there on the battlefield, I'm talking about the strong bonds between people that get to be, do things that we don't believe possible. In my own experience being in combat, I'm firmly convinced that men in battle really, you know, the flag and the Star Spangled Banner and all those things are very important to you and probably get you into uniform or get you to the field. But what gets you to from one side of the field to the other side of the field is the cohesion, the bonds you have with your fellow soldiers. They're going to go. They're not going to let you down. You're not going to let them down. And even today, I was talking to a group of educators, and we discussed the fact that throughout this pandemic, they found a number of people that they were working with, teachers, staff, et cetera, who had planned to retire, pulled their retirement papers during the pandemic because they were not going to let their teammates down. That kind of cohesion is essential to any organization.
We have a couple of minutes, Jeff. It's November 19th, 1863, a short speech by the President of the United States at Gettysburg. How does that help?
Well, it helps enormously because I think what Lincoln does is take the opportunity in that speech to cast a new vision for the organization. He realized that the timing for that was then. And, you know, John, he wasn't even the principal speaker that day. That was a guy named Edward Everett who had spoken for 2 hours before Lincoln. Lincoln had only been asked about 10 days before then to give his speech, which was 272 words. That particular speech is organized. You can break it into three parts that any leader can use. What are those parts? Where have we been 47 years ago? Where are we right now? We were met on the battlefield of this great war. Where are we going? We're going to a new birth of freedom. And up until that point, of course, the mission, the purpose of the war, what the organization of the United States was all about in this conflict was preserving the Union. Lincoln had said that in his first inaugural. In many ways, even the Emancipation Proclamation is really about preserving the Union, because it talks about freeing slaves only in the states under rebellion. Doesn't do you any good if you're a slave in Kentucky and Missouri, Maryland, for example. But with this speech now, when Lincoln says, you know, a new birth of freedom at the very end, what he's basically saying, in essence, I believe, is now the mission has been expanded, still preserving the Union, but freeing the slaves is inextricably linked to that. And in 1864, he will run on that particular platform, much to the chagrin, by the way, of many major Republican politicians who argue with the president, that's a loser of an issue. Do not run on that. We'll lose. Lincoln insists he must do so because by this point, a substantial number of African-American former slaves have fought, died, and bled for the Union.
The book is battle-tested. Jeff McCausland, the author. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.